So we'll be starting now the second part of Nikita Sutras, and what I'd like to just focus on, and which is going to be different to what we've been doing up till now, is methodologically, I'd like it to be clear that we're going to be doing sections in units. So there'll be units of Sukkim as opposed to just going through the narrative as it is, and at the end doing a Iyun, or a more in-depth analysis. What we're going to try to be doing is to spend time on a particular unit, understand that unit in and of itself, go into the depth necessary, and move on to the next one, so that we have defined little pieces rather than longer, elongated narratives. Okay, so that's going to be the hope with this next section, and in that regard, just as a help, in the source books, if you take a look. This is on, if everybody's got a source book, if anybody needs, there's extras as coming in the door. So starting on page 1, you'll notice that the first 5 psukim are in one section, and then there's a double line underneath the first 5 psukim. That's going to be our first unit, which is going to be about the death of the family of Naomi. That's going to be the first section. Going on from Pasuk Hey all the way to Pasuk Yudches is the unit of returning the journey or the attempted journey to return to Israel. And finally, from your test to Chav Beis in Perek Aleph is going to be the unit of Naomi's actual entering or re-entering into Beis Lechem. So just to view this as a map, we're going to be focusing on these as different sections, try to understand them on their own terms, do a little bit of a depth or an eon on each one, and then move on. Okay, so today's goal is going to be trying to understand the death of the family of Naomi, which is the first thing we're really introduced to in a very short span at the beginning of Megillas Rus. So starting last week, we didn't actually begin with the text. This week is the first time we actually enter the Megillah itself. All we have ahead of us is 5 psukim. 5 psukim to consider. We'd like to consider them on their own terms, and then consider them in a more retrospective manner, looking at the details of the themes within them. So, as we begin with that, starting on page 1, this is Vayhi Bimei Shvot HaShoftim. This was in the days when judges judged. It's a hard phrase to translate, that the judges judged. Shvot HaShoftim, we know about the judges, that's what we call Sefer Shoftim, but Shvot HaShoftim, the judges judged. That's an interesting way of framing it. Vayhi Ra'av Ba'aretz, and there was a famine in the land. Vayerech Ish V'Beis Lechem Yehuda Lagur B'Sdei Moav. Who the ishta ushrefanav? So we have a man. He's at this moment unnamed, and he comes from Beis Lechem or Bethlehem, and he went to dwell. The word over here lagur is permanent or temporary?
Temporary,
right? So the word lagur is a temporary dwelling. He wants to go for temporary dwelling where? In the fields of Moab. He and his wife and his 2 children. Okay, interesting juxtaposition, by the way, of the word sadeh and lechem. Just if we're going to keep our minds open to this, there's going to be an interesting movement over here between the field and the bread. Okay, just symbolistically, that's going to be relevant as we go on. There's two scenes in this story, and one is the field of Moab, and the other one is the house of bread or Beis Lechem. Out there. Now, question on the table is there a connection, or should there be a connection between the introduction of the Sefer and the rest of this Pasuk? Right, we're introduced to the Sefer by telling us that it was at the time of Shvot HaShoftim, and then we're told that suddenly this man is going. Is that relevant to the story? Is that just a time frame, or is that actually a detail in the story itself? Right? Well, we'd like to think that it is a detail. We do certainly know of certain svarim that begin with the time frame. You know, it talks about there's a let's say in the for example Amos, it tells you that a certain event occurred around then, and that's the thing. Welcome back, Valerie. This just the door if you need it. So what happens is we're told about the time frame. That's obviously relevant and important, but how closely does it relate to what's going on over here? So, on that note, it's worthwhile thinking and worthwhile understanding is that what is the, if we're going to go back to refrains or themes of Shoftim itself, What is one line or one sentence which comes to mind when you think about Shoftim?
Everybody did what was good in their
eyes. Right. So the line that we saw come up four times near the end of Shoftim is by Memahain, in those days, En Melech b'Yisrael, Isha Yashav ve'Enav Yaaseh. There was no king, so everybody did what they wanted. Does this relate to what we're being told over here? Well, perhaps yes. The Malbim suggests, and this is worthwhile thinking about, is that maybe the fact that you could have people just fleeing at the point of famine or a bit of economical trouble right here.
A fiscal cliff.
Exactly. right, so it did not say 2008 August, but yes, we understand that this is a very difficult situation. But how could it be that somebody just walks out, and we're going to see not just anybody walks out of Israel, is because there was no common leadership. Isha Yashar Be'enav Yaaseh means to say that everybody judged or deemed this the situation based on their own terms. So he saw that it wasn't a fit to stay. So what did he do? He walked out. Okay, so perhaps there's a connection in the refrain of Shoftim and what this person's doing. Just as an introduction, more than just the time frame. Okay? Yes, Marco.
I always did the same thing.
Fantastic. Fantastic. So I'd like to bring back your point in just a moment, is that it seems like this is not new to us. Vayehi Rav Baretz is not a new phrase. It happens before, and they leave. Yeah.
They were not leaving
a Jewish community. Oh, that's an interesting point. That's a fascinating point.
What did she say? I didn't hear her.
They weren't leaving a Jewish community.
That's a fascinating point.
They put themselves up, and it was everybody that came, and they left as a unit. This is about leaving, you know, his people in... You know,
that's a fascinating point. So I'd like to bring back this point and the two sides that are just mentioned over here when we discuss the themes of this section, in just which will probably be as we finish these five psukim very shortly, to try to understand what went wrong. Because all we're told about is really their death. So we try to understand what went wrong in any indications, and this will be one of the entry points into it. So in a moment we'll come back to these very good points. So here, that's what we have over here. I do have to mention that there are at least 15 options of what Shvat HaShoftim means. And we could sit here, listing them off for you. But I think there's one point, again, just in terms of the system or the style of learning, we'd like to be able to understand the psukim in a narrative, in a flow, that we get the picture of the story, rather than getting caught up in every possible detail that we could. Okay, so Shvat HaShoftim is the period of Shoftim. It could mean that their judges are being judged. That's the most common understanding that the Midrash discusses, is that means to say that even the judges were not living up to, were being judged. They weren't necessarily the strong leaders they were expected to be. That's a possibility out there. But without going into the myriad of explanations, I'd like to try to get the fuller picture of this section. Malka, yeah? Correct.
As is done all the way through.
Correct.
And the word Shvat is a gerund.
Correct. Judging.
It's the judging of the judges. Shvat. Smichut, and it's a.
Correct. 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 So it's not indicating who's doing it. Meaning it's describing the fact that there is a judging. So it could mean that they are doing the judging, it could mean that they are being judged. There's still room in that.
You get the idea of being judged is what the Shoftim did for a living.
The judging of the Shoftim. If I say that to you in English, that still has an ambiguous sound to it.
Right.
The judging of the judges.
Judging or they are being judged.
Right. I would still say there's an ambiguity. You're saying it's a weighted ambiguity. But I would still say there's ambiguity in the sense of, are they doing the judging? If they are doing the judging, then that's not really relevant for us to know, because that's their job. But if the judging of the judges means to say that they're being judged, then that's something that needs to be told to us. That would be the direction. What was that? No, it will not become up. That's what's interesting. This first description does not seem to be reflected elsewhere, except if you associate Boaz with a particular individual. But this really doesn't, which may be an indication as to this is the pshat and the pasuk, as the Malbim understands, that this is why this man could walk out right now. as simply as that. Possibility.
It's just the same as the later, you know, the Bima Runim. It's a time thing. This Navi was during the reign of such and such.
It's not what it's saying.
No, right. Point well taken.
What it's saying, this happened during.
You have that interpretation, but other people read it differently.
No, so I agree, and just again, Malcolm's making a good point. Every sefer starts off with a time frame. What I would like to appreciate over here is that there's more than the time frame as well, perhaps, and it relates to this specific story. And that's a possibility some of the Forshim deal with how it does. I think the most meaningful is the Malbim in terms of this person's actions, but absolutely, this is the baseline is the time frame. The question is taking it further to that, yes.
How far was it from Beit Lechem to Moab?
Okay, so just to, if you want to just jump for a moment geographically, over here to the last page of the source book. This is on page 11, if I'm not mistaken. There's not too much moving around over here, there's not so many maps necessary. But it's a good point to understand that this journey over here, if you look on the map, occurs. Beis Lechem is in the central part of Yehuda, which is in the center top area of the page, which is Beis Lechem. That's along the line is the highway, as we discussed before. And right next to the Dead Sea, those in the mountains over there. And the Stei Moav is when you cross on the other side of the Yam HaMelech. So there will be it could potentially be anywhere in that lower east southeast region of Israel, which is today where Jordan is. I think Jordan stretches all the way down there as well today. So that's what we're talking about, crossing over to Moav, our old buddies. Not the faintest. Not the faintest. We could definitely work that out, but I think there should be a scale on the map. Yes, the scale is in kilometers to 20. Every centimeter is a kilometer, so we're talking about roughly, if you were to take the highway, you're probably talking about 80 kilometers. Not too hasty.
Is it realistic to think that the situation of drought or whatever was different in such a short distance?
Oh, that's fascinating. So what Ruth is mentioning over here is that this is part of what we have to consider in terms of the punishment, is that usually when you have droughts, they affect regions, right? And if it's going to affect a particular region which is dependent on a river, then that region would affect all sides of that river. So it's interesting to note that there's a famine on one side of the river and there's another famine on the other side of the river, which is fascinating, which may lead it to have religious implications.
Right. A famine in Moab too. Do we know this specifically not? Because he has fewer responsibilities. He can have his own and not
have. That's mentioned. That suggestion is mentioned, but it's not. It seems to be that everybody understands that there is plentiful food over there. And certainly, if he's going to the fields of Moab,
yeah.
You know, it sounds like there's opportunity over there at this point in time. But that's a very good point, because when you have a particular famine, then there are religious implications of that famine, which means to say ignoring it becomes more serious. If it's something which is just, you know, we'll call it something which you could say, oh, well, you know, the whole world's in this particular position. Okay, there are religious, and there's always religious implications. But if there's a particular country which is being affected, and its neighbor's not, it's much more clear to understand that Israel's being affected for a particular reason. So ignoring that reason and going to the people not affected, it becomes much more serious then. So that's a very good point, well taken. What were your thoughts, Tina?
I understand the drought in Israel is not dependent upon water. It's not dependent on a river, but it's the rain that causes the rain. So it can certainly be rain in one country. And
Very possible. I just think that I don't think we should underestimate the effect of the Fertile Crescent, which reaches all the way down to the regions. But yeah, it is certainly primarily dependent on rain. Valerie.
It makes a lot of sense that there would be something going on one side of the river and something else going on there. I was just there. And it's ridiculous how in one area it could be really, really cold and snowing, where in another area it's still sunny.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So that is a function, the weather patterns. This is just an interesting point, and then we'll get to the second pasuk. Is that in general? Is that in 1948 they drew out, or 19 just after the 1948 war, they drew out boundaries, which they arbitrarily called the Green Line. And what's fascinating is once they got into space and they were able to start taking pictures of Israel, they found that, in fact, there was a green line which almost identically matched it, which was the place where Jews were living, which is that the whole of Israel had turned green. A desolate environment had turned green to where Israel had settled, which is fascinating because just a century back, Mark Twain, having marched through Israel, had declared this desolate land never possible to develop. So it's fascinating because the Torah says exactly that point. V'shamamu aleha v'yaveh ha'yoshim bo. So the Torah says that any of the enemies of Israel who dwell in that land will find desolation. They will never be able to produce fruit. So it's fascinating, on the one hand, that Israel does, and this is the opposite side of it, specifically produces in certain regions, where right next door is a land which you can't even irrigate. So that this notion of specified drought or success or irrigation is a hallmark of this land, which is particularly sensitive to our actions. That's the opposite side of it, exactly. So just moving on, Pasuk Beis. So we have this man leaving. We have potential reasons connected to the period. Now, V'shema ish Elimelech. Now we're told his name. His name is Elimelech. V'shem ishto Naomi. His wife's name is Naomi, which literally means pleasant. V'shem, in a very positive sense. V'shem shnei vonov Machlon v'Kilion. And his sons' names were Machlon v'Kilion, which are not so pleasant. So Machlon literally sounds like disease, and Kilion sounds like destruction. Right, so this, we're gonna get to see a little later on if these were their. One has to do this in Tanakh all the time. Is are these the names attributed to them because of their ends, or these names they originally had, and if so, why? Right, so that's going to be a discussion at a later point. One thing we will have to consider as well is the root of the word Kilion, which is the word Kol, or Kala, which means to finish. In this case, destruction. We're going to have to think about how that word appears later on in the Megillah. Keep your eyes open on that for that word as it appears later on. Ephratim. So these people are Ephratim. Mibes Lechem Yehuda from Bethlehem. Vayavosh Tei Moav Vayiyusham. They came to the fields of Moav and they were there. Ephratim translation. What is the word? The translation for the word Ephratim? Right. So it sounds like they could come from Ephrat, even though we were being told that they come from Beis Lechem. So, meaning, if that's the line that Sally's taking it, which is one explanation in Rashi, that means to say that Beis Lechem and Ephrat are two descriptions. Ephrat is perhaps the greater area, and Bethlehem is the city. It could also mean that Ephratim, as used elsewhere in Tanakh, is a description of greatness or of leadership. These are important people. That's an interesting point. And certainly this is corroborated by the word used in the first pasuk, Vayelech Ish. The word Ish used by itself also denotes a person of greatness. So it's possible this is just a geographical description, or it's possible that it's also describing their personage or their status in society as they move out. And that's relevant. That's going to be relevant in terms of what they're doing and why it's a problem. Important to notice, the intent was, what was the intent to be in Moab? What was the verb used? La Gursham, right? And we said that was a temporary word. The word used in this pasuk is Vayihiyusham. Temporary or permanent?
They were there.
Moving more towards the permanent, okay? Just in terms of the movement between these psukim. Intent and outcome seem to be a little different at this point in time. The intent was Lagur, the outcome was Vayihiyusham. Interesting in terms of the development of the story. Vayomas Avimelech Ish Naomi. So Elimelech dies, the husband of Naomi. Vatishaer hi ushnevoneh, and she and her two sons remain. Vayisu lahem nashim moavios. By the way, just actually before we get to Pasuk Dalet, do we not know that he is married to Naomi yet? Weren't we just told that? Right, we just know that a pasuk ago. So why is he being described in his death as the wife of Naomi, as the husband of Naomi? Is that important to us again to know? She's going to be the heroine of the story. That's definitely true. The story is always framed in the sense of from Naomi's point, that she is always the one losing out. That's an interesting point, from in terms of both her husband and her children.
And they don't tell you how he died.
We don't know how he died. We don't know how he died, but maybe it's not relevant in the sense that meaning is from in a perspective of we as the learners just know that he did die. And it seemed, leaving it at that for them at this moment.
Seemingly prematurely,
that's what it seems to be. It is possible to think that the reason why we're told that, he is the husband of Naomi is, as the Malbim points out, is that's all he had left. Now, if you're going to just play with that for a moment, we're going to get into this a little later on in 2 weeks' time, but that means if you take the line that he is an ish, that means to say he is a very important person in society, and important people also have lots of wealth. And his children are Ephratim, as we just described in the last pasuk, but now he dies, and all he has left is his wife. That indicates that he no longer has anything else. Meaning, ish Naomi is to express that he came down very wealthy. When he died, there was nobody else who cared. It was only his wife, because that's all he had. He only had his family, and so that's what the Malbim sees happening over here, based on a line in Midrash, which is interesting. Where else do we see precedence for that? By the way, that there's death only occurs after loss of property is by Eov. Okay, so we're gonna have to come back to that in 2 weeks' time to appreciate the comparison of this narrative to the Eov narrative. Okay, that's gonna be a comparison to come back to. Ruth, what are your thoughts?
Knowing that Mahlon and Kilion married these women, one would think they still had material goods left.
Okay, good points.
So,
point well taken.
What was the most important thing, Ish, given the importance that it was really Naomi that was his.
Okay, point well taken. And a number of the Mephoshim pick up on that. The later Mephoshim pick up on that point. That perhaps, no, he actually died with all his wealth. It was only later on, because after all, his children were able to marry so well.
Yeah.
You know, so that's that definitely exists as a possibility. But I think this is an intriguing joke that the Malbim makes, be it as it may. At the end of the day, there's nothing left. But the question is at which point, which is the point you're arguing, which is, I think, very relevant as well.
Or could it mean, you know, in this world, our wealth matters, but then once we're gone, all that matters is our family legacy?
So the one line that the Gemara picks up on is exactly that point, is that death is to family more than anybody else. Meaning, that's the, we'll call it the central sphere of influence, and that's where it's most... a person's greatest impact is as much as a person impacts the world and does many things, that the part of the focus here might be is this is where it counts. This is where it really counts. Timmy, what are your thoughts?
I think whether he lost his material goods or not, to me it says all he had left of his prestige was gone. Now his only identification was with somebody's husband.
Right, yes. That's taking this approach to the fullest extent. And the Mamlo Eis mentions exactly that point. So that's exactly that. Is that you see the development here. It's just interesting. In a few psukim, although we've been told very, very sparse details, you do see a little bit of a story unwinding over here. There's a leaving, there's an intent, the intent changes. He's dying, but he's dying in a different way in which he left, perhaps. Right? So you just, even in the sparse details, we're seeing a story unfolding. And finally, in Pasuk Dalet, Vayisulahem Nashim Moavios, they married Moabite women, Shema Achas Orpa Shema Shenis Rus. The first one's name was Orpa, the second one's name was Rus. Vayeshu Shom Keeser Shonim, and they dwelt there for about 10 years. Again, Vayeshu, temporary or permanent? Sounds?
Permanent,
right? So again, we've moved away from the Lagur, the temporary, and they're still in this mindset. To be dealt with next week is, are they Moabite women when they marry them? Okay, that'll be next week's discussion, not for right now. Did they convert them here or later? Yes.
Well, they weren't supposed to marry
Moabites.
Okay, so to be discussed. I want to discuss this in fuller depth, but I'd like to do that next week because I want to gain the appreciation of the death rather than the marriage right now. That's the for this week. But point well taken. Point well taken. Even if they may have been a heter. And finally, in Pasuk Hey, Vayamusu Gam Shnehem, Machlon and Nechilion, and they both died, Machlon and Nechilion. Vatishaer Ha'isha Mishnei Yoladei Me'isha, and the woman remained or survived both her children and her husband. and her husband. Fascinating points to pick up on here. Is number one is that when did they get married? Only after their father died. Interesting point. They only got married after their father died. This assimilation or potential assimilation process only occurs after the father's not there. Interesting point to think about. Number two, the Maimonides points out in the Igeres Shmuel, is that although it seems like, at least in the time frame that we're given, Elimelech is dying somewhat immediately, we know that Machlon and Nechilion are given a period of 10 years. Why? Because whatever they're doing wrong or perpetuating, it's more reactive than proactive. And this is an important point. Elimelech was proactively doing what he did wrong and therefore lost his life much earlier. They had a much longer scope of time because they had to break out of what was originally given to them. Okay, so the question is now getting out of that, they had a longer time in there to be able to rectify. And finally, over here, you'll notice a very sad point over here, is that the Midrash in Rus Rabbah, at the very, very beginning, says, when it says, Vayelech Ish, and the man went, the Midrash makes a very intriguing comment. It says, Ish v'ishto tzvelelo, his wife was secondary to him. This doesn't mean all relationships. This means in this relationship, she was secondary. Why? Because whose decision was it to leave Israel?
Yes.
Was his. She wasn't the party who wanted to go. And unfortunately, she was proven right. At the end of the story over here, she was proven terribly right. That the husband shouldn't have gone. But she was left without anybody. The very sad truth this Midrash points out over here. And that's perhaps why she no longer has a name in this pasuk. Do you notice that? At the beginning it was Naomi. She's lost her name by Vatishaher Ha'isha, the woman. Because she herself will say at the end of this pasuk is, don't any more call me Naomi. Right? The name pleasant or beautiful is no longer applicable to the situation that I'm in. Which is why even the narrative itself omits that point because of the suffering that she's going through right now. Okay, so just in terms of this view. Leo.
Strange that they were married 10 years and neither of them had a child.
That I was wondering that myself. I've not yet found a suitable answer to that. I was wondering exactly the same point, it would have been significant when they're leaving. When they're leaving, you would have imagined that you would have heard about it, and that's the point where, meaning right now you're right, but later on you would expect when they're leaving. Then that should be at least and certainly when Naomi's trying to convince them to go back, she should not be talking about their mother's house. They should be talking about your house. It sounds like they're not yet established, which is a good point, well taken. In the last few minutes, what I'd like to try to just focus on for today is trying to understand the premature deaths, certainly of the children, and also going back to Elimelech. Because they're somewhat different, but they're also very much the same. Okay, so that's the plan of trying to appreciate that. So there are a few suggestions mentioned out there. If we come back just to the thought, I'm moving right over here into the source books to page 5. To page 5 at the very, very bottom. This is Eon 2, why were the family punished so severely? So we left very, very sparse details. But there are a few suggestions. Suggestion number one, which comes to mind, and this is mentioned in a number of lines of Midrash and Mefarshim, is just the fact of leaving Israel itself. The Gemara points out, it is in Baba Basra. This particular Gemara you'll see, 91a, on Sadi Aleph Amud Aleph, going to Amud Beis, is the Gemara which is going to be quoted again and again, because this is the Gemara which focuses on Megillas Rus, if you're ever going to need it. So this particular line says, Tana Rabbanon, our rabbis taught, En yotzim eretz lechutz aretz, you cannot leave Israel if you're established there. Elohim kein omdu sasayim basela, unless everything is double the price. Meaning, unless the financial situation is such that everything is at double price. Now, this is not talking about whether you can live in chutz aretz at all. We're talking about a time where it's clear that people are established in the land and they're leaving happenstance without a very, very significant reason. And the Rambam actually codifies this in the second source. Osir, says the Rambam, Latzeis me'eretz Yisrael lechutz la'aretz la'olam. Person is not allowed just simply to leave Israel if one's living there. Ela l'ilmod Torah l'isa isha. Unless there is a requirement of learning Torah or to find one's soulmates, or lahatzil min ha'akum v'yasil la'aretz, or to evade persecution, and then return, and then of course to return to Israel. V'chein yotzehu l'schora, a person can leave on business, aval lishkon b'chutz la'aretz asur, elam kein chazak shom hara'av. A person is not allowed to leave Israel, and unless there is a very strong famine, ad she'na'ase shove dinar chitin b'shnei dinar, until the price goes up double. Okay, so he goes on to describe a few of the details. So Rambam takes this very seriously, and notice that this suggestion that the Gemara is pointing out here, which does relate to Megillas Rus, is not referring to their interactions with other people at all. It's just simply by itself the leaving. By itself, the leaving has a severe impact. That's the way the Gemara is describing it. And the problem with such a notion is, as Malka mentioned, is that, let me read another pasuk which perhaps we are familiar with, which is the Vayihira of Baretz. There was a famine in the land. Same words that we used in the first pasuk in Megillas Rus. Vayered Avram Mitzrayim alagur sham. Avram went to Egypt. What was the word? Again, lagur, temporary dwelling in Egypt. Ki chaved hara av ba'aretz, because the famine was heavy in the land. It sounds like almost an identical story, and we're going to compare it a little later, in fact, the aftermath of that story. But it sounds like if Israel is the only factor over here, you're going to have to start making hairline divisions over here between what type of famine. He was going to Egypt, they were going to Moab. Those are both chutz la'aretz, those are both outside of the scope of Israel. So if it's just leaving Israel alone, It's harder to fathom that being the issue which is really at hand over here. It may be certainly a significant part of it, but not necessarily the only. Esther, what were your thoughts?
Well, he was probably sick. Elimelech was the leader.
Okay, great.
We didn't say that.
Right, so absolutely. At this point in time, I just want to be careful. There's going to be four suggestions that I'd like to bring up over here in the next few minutes, but I'd like to investigate them individually. So this over here, just to appreciate that this is all the accusation that's being laid on their shoulders is leaving Israel. On that grounds alone, we have people who have done that, and it's harder to be mechalek to see how it differs. It probably does differ. It sounds like the Ra'av was kaved in the case of Canaan. But by itself, just leaving the land doesn't seem to be enough by itself. So now, what was that? Okay, so but you're suggesting something else. So, moving on to another point, is before we even get to status, is when Avraham went down to Mitzrayim, his intents were again, what's the word used? Lagur, to dwell. What were the intents of Elimelech and his wife as well? Lagur as well, same word, to go to it temporarily. But, what was the end result? Vayihi Yushan says the Malbim, if exactly on this point, this is on page 6 under the in source 3, it's called settling down. This is the Malbim speaking. Vayavo rotze lomar. What does it mean? They came. Vahagam shetchila yatzu rak lagur b'stemo av l'fisha. Even though they intended only to come just to dwell, achar shebo stemo av hayusham. Once they arrived, they set up. They got a house. They started paying a mortgage. Right, they got involved in the stock market. Then they became involved. They wanted to stay there on a more permanent basis. So what this does is it effectively deepens the first suggestion. It's not just leaving, but it's leaving and forgetting the ultimate goal. Because remember, the Rambam had said there are reasons one can leave Israel. But what was the Rambam's words? V'yachshar la'aretz. He should have intent, or he should, in the end of the day, return to Israel. Avram did. Elimelech didn't. What was that? Correct. One of the things he mentioned was persecution. But actually, the Rambam did visit when he was able to.
And they stayed there for a little while and then they left.
Fantastic. It would be fascinating to go into the history of that time, which is very turbulent. But one of the things which is important to realize is the Rambam at that point in time did not had to support himself, and his profession was, among other things, was the physician to the Sultan. So that was his particular way of financing himself. But you're right; it's interesting to view how this.
He said that he sinned his whole life first by living in Egypt.
I'd be interested to see that. I don't remember hearing that, but that is very fascinating. That is very fascinating. Because, yeah, how the halacha affects it. By the way, just to be careful, where the halacha over here is talking about leaving Israel, meaning a person who is living and not and leaving on their own free will. That's what it's talking about. It's not talking about necessarily people living there because of. Rather, living in Chutz Haaretz because of, just to appreciate that. That's a much greater discussion. So just to differentiate right over here, leaving Israel, is that enough by itself? Leaving and staying deepens the situation. Two possible suggestions, which are adopted by first the Gemara and then the Midrash. But now, it gets more than that. There is a notion, what's called Poresh Min HaTzibur, to separate oneself from the community. And the Gemara in Tanis describes, this is not actually in the sources, but describes that if a community is going through a troubling time, and somebody, anybody at this point in time, before we get to Esther's point, anybody who moves out of that because they don't want to be under the depression, they go back to the house and they eat and drink while everybody else is suffering, is particularly set aside or identified and not to be part of the salvation of that community. I mean, it's a very scary thing. The Rambam has very nasty words to say about this. And in fact, just as a historical point, I was in Israel in Keren B'Yavne at the end of my stay. I was there during the Hitnat Kut, the disengagement from Gaza. And the policy of Ari Yeshiva was to be very supportive of the Tefillah B'Tzibur's, the great prayers that it shouldn't happen, and supportive demonstrations, not demonstrations, but gatherings of people in Gush Katif at the time. And I remember there was one particular tefillah which was so strong, which was like it was supposed to be everybody coming to the Kotel at that time, that the Rosh Yeshiva put on a page outside the Beis Medrash. He quoted this Rambam talking about the degree of seriousness of somebody who separates themselves from the community when the community is suffering. So that in my mind sticks out of like, you know, sort of, you know, taking the back entrance and walking out while everybody else is suffering. So over here is whether Elimelech at this point in time is important or not important, whether the children are important or not important, before you even get there, the notion of somebody walking out when everybody else is suffering, as perhaps a function of Shvat HaShoftim, as we discussed at the beginning, that's a very troubling thing in and of itself. But it gets worse. These are all preliminary discussions. The reason why these are not sufficient to explain this particular course of events is the outcome. Is do these justify the level of suffering? Do these events really justify the level of suffering of Naomi? That's very hard to say. It's very hard to say that Naomi, who is widowed and orphaned, is because of these particular things. There's something much more over here. There's something much more going on over here.
I realize we're saying two different things. I mean, in what you're saying, it's the men who die.
So correct.
Think of their lives that are ended, and yet it's Naomi that's left suffering.
Correct.
And she's the one that did.
They suffer, and she suffers. Correct. They suffer, but in a funny sense, their suffering is somewhat cut short in this world, at least. Which is an interesting point.
They know what their suffering was here. They may not have suffered.
Correct. Also, maybe not as much in this world anymore.
In the next world,
there's also things to sort out. But, certainly. So it's important to focus on that there is on both sides. On both sides. Just being very careful over here. We'll discuss more of this when we get to the EO comparison to this particular story. But on both sides, These reasons are, they're bad things, and they're things which one should certainly avoid, but to the degree of suffering that this family as a whole suffered, the individuals who died and the individuals who remained, it doesn't necessarily justify it, seemingly from our perspective. Which is what leads us to a more intriguing conclusion. A more intriguing conclusion, and remember, we are given the details. The Baal HaMegillah, the person who's writing this Megillah, which is Shmuel HaNavi, is giving us the details that we're supposed to learn the lessons from. We're only being taught the things which are relevant for us. So that's what we're trying to do over here. Because we're not given the full historical background. We're given the specific necessary components. And perhaps there is something else going on over here. And that is the following. As we noted, and what Esther was pointing out just earlier, is that he was important, he was an Ish. His children were Ephratim, which means to say on one line that they were nobles, they were respected people. And now put into that together what Ruth had said at the beginning, is that where are they leaving from? They're not leaving from a land where they had set up tents like Avraham Avinu in the beginning. They're leaving from Beis Lechem Yehuda, where ostensibly, and remembering that every tribe is in the time of Shoftim is living in their own territory with their own families, you can expect that there was a lot of family around as well. So what's happening? He's moving away. He and his family are moving away from his relatives, his townsfolk, the people who looked to him as a leader. What type of leader one could expect in terms of the command of the situation, in terms of finances as well. So now you have somebody over here, not just Poresh Min HaShivah, not just leaving Israel and settling it down somewhere else, somebody who the community looked towards. Okay, but it gets deeper. Right? The base level, so expand. I'm not getting it yet. Oh yes, yeah, absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. So we're going to have to consider the grain journey, which we did, for those who remembered last year, Shavuos. Those who remembered that we did discuss this a little bit over there. The point well taken. So just to come down to this point, there is a this is what the Yalkut Shimoni says in source 6. The Yalkut Shimoni points out the Lama Ne'enash. This is on page 6, source 6. The Lama Ne'enash. Why were they punished? Lefi shehipil Libon shall Yisrael, Libon shall Yisrael. They threw down the heart of Israel. And I think it's supposed to be, if I'm not mistaken from reading it inside before, it's supposed to be the word moshel right over there. There's a moshel lebulyutus shel melech. There's an office of the king, shehaya shori b'medina, that the king had a particular office who was in the country. V'hoya b'nei medinos betuchin alav. Everybody depended on him. And they knew that if anything were to happen, this person was so powerful they could finance the entire surroundings for 10 years. Interesting number, right? But when the years of Batsores, of need, came, his maidservant was outside collecting. Kach Elimelech, Migdolei Hador, Mifarnasei Hador haya. Elimelech was a leader of the generation and one of the financial cornerstones of the generation. V'kevon shebo'u shnei ra'avon, when the years of drought came, Omar Ashav Yihiu Kol Yisrael Mesubim Mekupasan Apis Apischi. Now everybody's going to come to my house and ask for money. V'zeh Baba Kupasan, V'zeh Baba Kefifoy. Everybody's coming with their bags to ask for food. Ma'asa Omad Ubarach Mipnehem. He ran away from them. This is what caused him to leave Beis Lechem during the times of famine. So over here is more insidious. Here now we're getting to a new level. It's not just Israel. It's not just staying there. It's not just separating oneself from the community. It's moving away when people are dependent. People are dependent on you. And this expectation all falls flat. But it gets even worse than that. Because who did they move to? Where did they move to? They moved to a place called Moab. If we're in the Sefer Shoftim, Moab is most of the time, except for a short period, subservient to Israel. Certainly if he's going to be at the later period of Shoftim. So they're moving not only to the enemies of the Jews, but Moab. Now Moab is a history. Moab has a history. What is the history? What is the reason why Moab and Ammon have a ban on intermarriage on them in the Torah?
Israel left Egypt.
Fantastic. When Israel left Egypt and they were now in the desert looking for help, Moab and Ammon were the ones not specifically to decline help. That's what the Torah says. The Torah says very explicitly in the Pasuk that you cannot marry a Moabite or an Ammonite. Why? This is in Devarim Perikov Gimel. They didn't come out to greet you with water and food. And also, what happened? What did they do? They were the ones who rented Bilam ben Beor to curse you in Parshas Balak. So these are not only were they not giving you food, but they also were negative. Now let's think about this for a moment. Is there an expectation on them? I apologize, we're really closing on the time. So just to think about this carefully as a... to close all the points together. Were they expected to give us water and food as we left Egypt?
Yes.
Was there an expectation? Why was there an expectation for them to give us food?
Because they were related.
Let's go back in history. When Moab and Ammon were at a point of danger, when the parents of Ammon and Moab, which are Lot and his daughters, were about to be destroyed, Avram extends himself to the degree that he argues with God to defend them. Not only are they related, but they have a blood debt, in a sense, to pay. And what happens when their brethren walk out into the desert? They don't not only ignore that debt, but they rent somebody else to curse Israel. That, says the Ramban, which is quoted in our source book, we're not going to do inside, is the reason why there's such a severe treatment to them. There were many other nations who ignored us. They shouldn't have. They were expected to treat us as brothers, and as brothers who saved them when they were at a time of trouble. Now, let's come back to our story for a moment. We have the two children. We have the two children of Elimelech. Elimelech, who's moved, as opposed to financing and being the cornerstone of the community where he was expected to be, he moves to the people who don't support people. He moves out of Israel to the people who specifically don't support Israel. And then what happens? Not only does that occur, but his sons assimilate, marrying into that very culture. Marrying into the culture which was the one not to finance Israel. That's the epitome. That's the epitome of a slap in the face. To move to the place, to move away from supporting, to the place which doesn't support, is much more of a troubling system over here. Which is why, and with this we end, it's going to be so important to follow the train of Chesed through the Megillah. Because we're going to find somebody who is leaving the place of Moab, the people who are labeled as the people who don't support their brothers in need when there's a debt. And she's going to be the person who goes beyond her means to support her mother-in-law and her family, where her husband and father-in-law were killed for moving away from that into this culture. It's not by coincidence that Moab is the one involved over here. We'll end with that today. I apologize.